You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of May, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme, Britain's Prime Minister seeks a reformed bond with Brussels as he sets out on a European charm offensive. My guests, John Everard and Roger Boys, will tell us what Cameron wants and what he's likely to end up with. Also ahead, after the trial of a Washington Post reporter opens in Tehran, we ask what chance of a fair trial and how will it shape already tense relations between the US and Iran. Plus, we discuss Russia as it flexes its muscles in a massive Air Force exercise. Plus, we ask, is China's economy in trouble? And should we be worried? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Roger Boys, who's the diplomatic editor of The Times here in the UK. Welcome both gentlemen to the programme. Now, let's start by discussing the future of the European Union and its bond with Britain. That was the subject on the table last night when David Cameron hosted the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, at his country residence, Chequers. The talks came ahead of a busy week for the British Prime Minister, who wants to renegotiate the UK's ties with Brussels. He hopes to speak with all 27 EU leaders before a European Council meeting at the end of June, where he's expected to set out his reform plans in greater detail. So what does Cameron want and what's he likely to get? Roger, is anyone really listening to this round of shuttle diplomacy?
Well, I think just the mere fact that he's doing it is amazing because he seems to have zero coalition skills. Frankly, any sort of minor Balkan power in Eurovision has more flexibility, more elasticity, imagination about how to form alliances than he does in Europe. So it's quite astonishing that he's doing this. The truth is, it's going to be a problem. It's a problem partly of his own making. That's to say that the referendum calendar looks like being incredibly tight. That's to say probably 2016 now, not 2017. It's a problem because France and Germany are not sleeping. And have worked out their own way of making this not into a big discussion about treaty change. And it's a problem because he won't really tell us what he wants. He wants, it seems, curbs on welfare spending for EU immigrants. He wants a few other things, and some of the people he visits will say, we agree. But that's not enough.
John, we have to be fair to him. He's dealing with with some issues which impact on the electorate here, whether we believe them or not. But 641,000 people moved to the UK in 2014, an increase of 50% compared to 2013. Now, he had to face up to some testing times from UKIP as challengers here in the elections, a party that was determined to raise the immigration debate. And it just rattles on this story for the Conservatives for year after year. So in a way, if he could negotiate something, if he could go to the British people and say, this is in the end what I believe, I've got enough reforms, I'd like to stay in, he would be on a winning game. But as Roger said, he's set himself a timetable that really kind of makes it seem very unlikely that he's going to get any of these kind of changes through, isn't it?
I think he's done this deliberately. I think he wants to signal that he's serious about this and that this is going to move ahead at a very brisk pace. Is he going to get treaty changes through? Probably not, but he may be able to get commitments to treaty changes in that period. That might well be enough to sell domestically. And you're right, there is a real domestic head of steam behind this. I mean, the votes in the general electorate we just had were proof enough that there's widespread concern about immigration. And of course, not just in the UK. The French press in particular this morning, I see, are portraying this as just David Cameron against the rest of the EU. It's not that way at all, as we've seen from the political landscape, not least in the Polish elections we've just concluded. There is concern about movement of people and free movement of people in many other countries too. When it comes to immigration, I think he is going to have a real uphill struggle to negotiate anything that hacks away at what many Europeans regard as the core value of free movement of people. He may, however, have more success in negotiating limited rights for inter-European migrants to British welfare payments before they spend a certain period of time in the UK. That would be unwelcome, particularly to the Poles. And Gazeta Wyborcza has got a huge spiel on this morning, denouncing Cameron's attempts to change the rules. But it wouldn't actually offend so many fundamental treaties as any kind of restriction on movement of people themselves.
Roger, he seems to believe, you know, that the British aren't happy with the status quo, and maybe they're not. But when it comes to a vote, what's your feeling? Actually, that things may have changed, the landscape may have changed around him. That, you know, sure, there's some loud voices saying that we need to renegotiate. That, but in the end, the British public may be a little bit more open-minded to Europe than he imagines.
I think that's correct. But at the moment, he's partly reconstructing the Tory party as a blue collar party in order to fend off UKIP competition, and it's these people who are the most sensitive to competition for social housing. For example, a lot of Poles come over, they do, for example, carpentry jobs. Some of it's cash in hand, some of it not. And instead of going home as they used to, they're putting their children through school. And they're claiming social housing. And all of this is actually putting strain on certain communities. And the Tories want those people. So there is a specific calculation about securing your base core constituency. And then there are loads of people who don't care. That's to say, they'd like to stay within the European Union, and they don't really care at all about the common fisheries policy. And they don't care about an awful lot of other things. They don't want a wholesale renegotiation. But that's okay with Cameron too. He doesn't really want a wholesale renegotiation either. He wants just enough goodies to present to win the referendum and carry the day. Don't forget, referendums traditionally have had pretty low turnouts. You don't need much to win them. And I'm sure that he's going to win this.
And just tell me, you know, as a diplomatic editor, when you look at the European landscape, on the other side of the table, it's very easy for the, you know, at the moment, for the, you know, the Germans and the French to sound rather nonchalant about the whole process. But do you think at the end, you know, they are probably a little bit more worried about, you know, a breakup? You know, they don't want Greece to leave, let alone a big partner like the UK.
Well, they've got a lot going on, haven't they? I mean, Greece, as you say, might default in the next couple of weeks. You've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of migrants coming over from North Africa. You've got institutions under strain, and you've got populism. You know, as John said, the Polish president, Andrzej Duda, is by any stretch of the imagination a populist president. So they are worried about splintering of the Union, that's for sure. And both have elections in 2017, the France earlier than the Germans. To a very European sensitive electorate, much more sensitive than we are. So it's all a bit of a mishmash, and I think the threat of chaos that Britain can introduce into this system may be enough to win him some useful concessions.
John, occasionally when we've had German correspondents in here talking about this issue, they've said, well, actually, you know, maybe it's not reflected in the political landscape, but actually when you speak to the electorate, even in Germany, there's a feeling that actually Cameron's got a point, and that maybe that is his kind of chance. You know, in the end, you know, Angela Merkel will feel, okay, I'm not a big kind of fan of Cameron, but I do think that even my own electorate will be pleased to see a little bit of reform around the edges.
Yes, I think that's right. Indeed, there have been a lot of voices through the German electorate who've been saying just that. And one of the aspects of this that I think makes Juncker, the president of the Commission, just a little bit nervous is that now that the UK has stuck its flag in the ground, so to speak, on these issues, that other people are likely to rally around it. Can I, by the way, pick up a point you made just now about the public in the UK? I think, as Nicola Sturgeon reminded us all very forcibly this morning, when we talk about UK hesitations over Europe, we mean overwhelmingly English hesitations. The polls show quite clearly that support for the EU in Scotland, in Wales, and I think, though I'm not so sure, in Northern Ireland is not 100%, but it is significantly higher than it is in England. This, of course, is going to feed into the parallel conversation that David Cameron is having with the SNP over the great SNP victory in Scotland is going to sit alongside the Tory victory elsewhere in the UK.
And I just think, you look at the, oddly on a different subject, you look at the vote at the weekend in Ireland about gay rights, and they didn't realise how much the landscape had changed around them. And I think that's a little bit like the same here. If you're a generation that's grown up the whole time in the EU, you've holidayed in Europe, you've always used the euro, your auntie's got a flat in Marbella, then suddenly you're part of a generation that doesn't think about Europe in the same way as, actually, to be honest, a lot of people who never go to Europe, who don't have that much to do it, but who are nervous of it, as you say, in the sense of migration, because it's affecting their communities at a lower level. Roger, do you think that, again, we have to come back to the feeling, because it's interesting that they are trying to, that they don't want to bring in young people on this vote. They don't want to extend it, as they did in Scotland, to 16-year-olds. Again, do you think that's because they realise that actually the 16-year-olds are almost definitely going to vote for staying in the EU?
Well, yes, quite possibly, or they're not going to vote at all and therefore create this, inflate the low turnout figure to make it the referendum even more nonsensical than it already is, really. It is a problem. We are modernising and we are not registering how fast we're modernising. And you're right. Ireland was a complete shock to a lot of the Catholic rooted Irish establishment. They really weren't expecting that. Attitudes are changing. I think this referendum is really, at the moment anyway, a complete irrelevance to 16-year-olds.
Not just youth. Of course, the decision to exclude the 1.5 million European Union citizens who live in the UK. Furious editorial in Le Monde this morning, thumping the table and saying, is it right that an Indian who lives in London should be able to vote on this, but not a Frenchman?
Is it right for a French newspaper to be utterly racist about it? One could also ask.
Well,
I mean, I see no problem with accepting the general election franchise as a basis for a referendum, especially when you've got such a short notice.
Well, we're going to move on to another thorny subject now, and that's Iran, where the trial of Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian has opened behind closed doors. The journalist has been detained for almost 10 months, and the charges against him include espionage. The Committee to Protect Journalists has called on the authorities there to ensure a fair and transparent trial. But what hope of that? And how will the case shape US-Iran relations as world powers try to strike a deal on Tehran's nuclear ambitions? John, quickly remind us of the details of this case.
Yes, Sarfati, as you say, sort of arrested 10 months ago along with his wife, and it now turns out with another lady, a photographer for the Washington Post, held in a kind of limbo for month after month. It was only very recently that they actually explained what kind of charges were going to be laid against him. It turns out espionage, passing secrets to a hostile power, unnamed but of course the United States, and anti-Iranian propaganda, which I don't think we knew was actually a crime, but it turns out that in certain circumstances it can be. His trial started just today, behind closed doors, so much for the great calls for transparency and openness and fairness. Worse, the presiding judge is Sarfati, known as the judge of death because of his habit of handing down the death sentence in areas where other judges might just have handed down custodial sentences. It looks from the outside as if the whole thing is stacked against Jason, and the Iranian authorities have been notable by their silence on this. Normally, in these kind of circumstances, you get some kind of Iranian communique explaining what is going on, but nothing in this case. In fact, the only people talking about the case appear to be the Western media, and in particular, of course, the Washington Post, for whom Jason has worked for so long.
Now, two of the pieces of evidence against him apparently are that he made a visa application for his wife to go to the United States, and that he also wrote a letter to President Barack Obama saying, if you need any help in US-Iran relations, I'm your man. I'd like to support their improvement. So neither of those seems to be huge pieces of evidence against him. But Roger, there is a diplomatic story at the heart of this. You know, there's huge negotiations going on. These things tend to get caught up in backwater channel discussions between the two countries. What do you make of the diplomatic situation?
If I can just complete the thought about Jason's vulnerability, it's of course that he's an Iranian citizen as well as an American citizen. And since Iran doesn't recognize double citizenship, he's regarded as an Iranian citizen who has independently sent a letter to the White House administration, independently done this, and has therefore violated certain laws. That's how the Revolutionary Court is proceeding. But it is a Revolutionary Court. It is, therefore, out of the scope, really, of Rouhani, and one has to assume that this is some kind of pawn, or a bargaining chip in some kind of game, a domestic political game in Tehran, and that they're accumulating, the hardliners are accumulating different elements as we head towards a possible nuclear deal next month. So I don't know. The Iranian foreign minister has just said that he's concerned that, there may be misunderstanding and all this kind of stuff. But it's quite clear that Zarif and some of the other Rouhani team are really completely out of the loop on this, that it's something being engineered as part of a political power struggle. And I'm afraid these things don't really end well.
John, as you were saying, I think we've answered the question whether there is any hope of a fair trial. But just discussing there the diplomatic tangle, do we feel that at the end there may be some negotiation that so far the Americans have been keen not to wrap the two issues together? They want a deal on the nuclear ambitions, and then they'll look at this separately. But do you think in the end they may get wrapped up together if there is a good deal that comes out of the negotiations?
I very much doubt it. I think the Americans are being very careful not to link these two. That is precisely what the hardliners want. The moment that you get a linkage between Jason Rezaian and the nuclear discussions, the hardliners effectively have a hostage in those negotiations, which of course would distort the process completely. So I think the United States would die in the last ditch before it allowed that. I am not sure you'll get a deal. I think what might well happen is that if, keep our fingers crossed, the nuclear deal goes through and is finally ratified on both sides, that if Jason Rezaian's imprisonment is simply to do with conflicts within the Iranian establishment over this deal, that once his usefulness to the hardliners expires, if a deal goes through, that he will be just quietly released. We've seen this happen in the past. The Iranian judicial system can be remarkably flexible when it comes to prison terms when the political situation is right.
Don't forget, there's Congress also to be considered. And we might have a situation or the Iranians might be able to create a situation where a congressman flies over to Tehran to plead for the life of an American citizen. You know, there are all sorts of games underway.
Well, we should certainly be watching with interest what happens there in Tehran to Jason Rezaian. Now, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Ajitak, and my guests today are John Everard and Roger Boys. Coming up next, more muscle flexing from Russia. Stay with us.
As the diplomatic wrangle over the Arctic continues, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis travelled to the Arctic Council's meeting in northern Canada to assess, on film, the path ahead for this strategically important area.
The Arctic Council is often held up as an example of how an international diplomatic body should operate. It has a strong track record of resolving territorial disputes peacefully and dealing with the shifting Arctic landscape in all its forms through measured negotiation.
Circle of Friends, the Art of Arctic Diplomacy, a Monocle movie, now premiering in the film section of monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are John Everard and Roger Boys. Now to a tale of muscle flexing that's become all too familiar of late. Russia has launched air defence exercises in the Ural Mountains and Siberia, involving thousands of servicemen and around 250 aircraft. That's according to the country's defence ministry. The drills, launched yesterday, are set to last until Thursday. But they're seen as a mere warm-up for a bigger exercise in September, and come as NATO and some of its partners start their own Arctic training exercises. John, is this a surprise? What's going on?
It is. It would be nice if it were a surprise. Sadly, we've got to a stage now in Russia's relations with the West where it is not a surprise that if NATO stages an exercise, that Russia responds. I'm old enough to remember the Cold War, and all of this looked horribly familiar. One side exercises, the other counter-exercises, both sides deny there's any link between the two exercises, and they end up just glaring at each other over the top of very, very large amounts of weaponry. It's all quite uncomfortable. Made more uncomfortable in this case by the fact that the very first paragraph of the TASS report on these exercises talks about practicing the use of cruise missiles on the enemy's ground targets, which, if you are sitting somewhere in the Baltics, probably doesn't make very comfortable reading.
Roger, what do you make of these exercises?
Well, they seem to be staged, or are going to be staged, over Siberia and the Urals, so we can draw certain conclusions from that. It could be that they're revving up for the Arctic. They worry a lot about the Arctic. I mean, this is, you know, if we're talking about strategic planning, then the divvying up of the of Arctic resources is, you know, one of the great focal points of military planning in general. They want to show they can do it. They want to show that they can mobilize 250 aircraft. You know, they have cheap fuel. You know, we'd have a problem sometimes mobilizing that many aircraft. And they want to show that they've, you know, that they're still a player, that they're not around, you know, that they haven't drifted away in these months before the conclusion of the Minsk agreement. They want to show that they're still, you know, that the triad is still there, that they can deliver things from the air, nasty things from the air. They, you know, they can deliver nasty things from sea, and they've got loads and loads of tanks. So, you know, it's just a statement of presence, really. Plus, there hasn't been an aerial exercise on that scale for quite a long time, so it is sort of due.
And do you think this is the new status quo now, John? Because what's interesting is, you know, that at the end of the summer, there is a chance for the EU kind of sanctions against Russia to come to an end. But if all this is going on, nobody's going to have the appetite for changing that. It'll be more of the same. Is this just where we're at now?
Yes, I think that's right. And I agree with you that against this background, that nobody's going to be arguing very strongly for any kind of suspension of sanctions. There's another angle to this, the quality of the weaponry that the Russians are deploying. Now, Russia is in the midst of a military modernization program, but it hasn't got to the end of that program yet. And one of the things that everybody will be watching will be just how effective the Russian cruise missiles are and how the aircraft perform. A lot of Russia's air force is really quite antiquated, and they've got the numbers, 250, as we keep saying, but they haven't really got the quality. And frankly, the contrast between rather slow, lumbering aircraft in the Russian exercises and the much sleeker, faster ones in the NATO exercises will probably make a few people in Moscow just a little bit nervous.
Well, we're going to move on to our final topic of the day, and it's a big one, China. Its economic growth appears to have lost momentum, and some fear that if the trend continues, a crash of sorts could be in store. But could this vast state ever truly crash, and should the world really be concerned at this time? John, what's going on?
We've been saying for a year now that the gloss has come off the Chinese economy, growth rate has started to slow. There was a key moment last December when it became clear that Indian economic growth had finally overtaken China's. Things from then have gone from bad to worse. We now have a slowing growth rate. Officially, we are down from 10% a year to 7% a year. But in fact, I, for one, don't believe that figure. Li Keqiang, now the Prime Minister of China, when in an earlier incarnation, told the then US ambassador to ignore the official economic statistics coming out of Beijing, which were largely fraudulent. He said that if you want to know what is going on in the economy, you measure rail freight, bank lending, and total energy consumption. If you do that, the number that tumbles out isn't 7%, it's 5%. So really sort of a significant gap there. So slowing growth on the one hand, which the authorities have tried desperately to pump up by vast amounts of liquidity. I mean, the package that they brought out in 2008 was absolutely gigantic and extremely wasteful. A lot of infrastructure projects that went wrong, bridges in the middle of nowhere, empty apartment blocks and so on. That on the one hand. As a corollary, we have got an absolutely huge overhang of unpayable debt held by, or owed rather, by mainly by Chinese local authorities and Chinese companies. We are now in a situation where Chinese companies as a whole will have to find $1.35 trillion in interest payments, which is more than their entire projected profit. So they're rather in the situation of an individual who finds that his mortgage payments are higher than his salary. It's not a good place to be. The local authorities, meanwhile, have kept borrowing. The Chinese central government has had to tell banks to keep lending to these people regardless. The banks are trying to draw in, recognising they weren't going to get their money back. But a director's gone out, they've got to keep lending. At a time, remember, when Chinese deflation, as measured by the producer price index, is between 4 and 5%. Prices are falling at between 4 and 5% a year, which means, of course, that these debts are getting larger and larger in real terms. In real terms, Chinese interest rates now are rather over 10%. Now, with all that going on, you do not have to be a financial expert to hear the bomb ticking. China has tried repeatedly to kick the can down the road, avoid having to face up to these problems. But at some stage, this is going to blow. And that's not a political or an economic judgment. That is simple arithmetic. This cannot go on.
Roger, it's such opaqueness around China in almost everything it does. You know, we get the party line, the party line, and we're meant to follow that. When you see these kind of cracks in the statistics being shown, do you take an interest, a diplomatic interest in them as well?
Well, you do worry about I must say that was a miserable list that John just produced.
He knows how to cheer you up, doesn't he?
Well, he really does. To which I would only add a property bubble. So if we add the property bubble on top of that, then you've got Apocalypse Now, really. But of course, the nervousness is that this kind of economic vulnerability translates into more nationalistic and more aggressive foreign policy. There's no logic why that should be the case, but it's the way it often happens. In fact, if you want to upset a Chinese official, all you have to say is that China's heading the same way as Japan, and you can test the temperature dropping right at that moment. The military and the defense establishment in general does seem to be largely shielded from all these developments. It's certainly out there. You know, it's certainly out in the South China Sea. It's flexing itself in the East China Sea. It's creating what I would say could be some kind of nationalistic diversion, because if you're in an autocratic state or a semi-autocratic state, or however we define China, then one possible outcome for all the bad economic indicators, steel dropping and so on, is to militarize and to step up tensions and to go towards a war.
We've only got a few seconds left, 20-odd seconds. Do you think that it questions, John, the stability of China?
Yes, and I'm not the only person saying that. I saw a senior commentator just over the weekend talking about the beginning of the end of the Communist Party of China. A political structure does not survive this kind of pressure without either significant changes or cracking. Final point, if I may.
Quick one.
If China goes, this isn't just a China problem. This is world recession mark two.
Well, you heard it. We've cheered you up today, haven't we? You can rely on these two gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. That was, of course, John Everard and Roger Boyes. Thank you both for joining us on Midori House. And that's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sarah Mineta, and also Mariana Zuniga. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. But from me, Angie Tuck, it's just time to say thank you for listening and see you tomorrow.